I appreciate the opportunity that I have to speak to you at this point in time. I kept thinking while I was getting ready to come up here, but I guess that makes me the bitter end. But I am here to discuss with you Daniel chapter 11. It's interesting that any time that you're going to present a lesson, whether it be in the preaching school or preaching in Spanish or teaching Bible class and spent to the Spanish congregation, that you, the preacher, the teacher, is the one that learns the most. And you find out things that that you never knew before. I appreciate this congregation at Southwest for all the things they have done for me in so many ways. I was able to study here and be a graduate of one of the best Christian schools in America, the Southwest School of Bible Studies. And I will always be forever indebted for all the fine teaching, the fine instructors that they had and they still have to prepare other men to be preachers. At this time, if you open your Bibles with me to chapter 11, in the book of Daniel, this is a very interesting chapter. It is very historical. There's a lot of history involved here in regards to the empires of Persia, Greece, and also in regards to the Jewish people. As you have heard from so many fine speakers up to this point, in regards to Daniel, the kind of man that he was, the kind of young man that he was when he was first taken into Babylonian captivity in the year 606, under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar of the Babylonian Empire, and his companions, the kind of character that he had, which would tell us the kind of training he must have had from his parents. There's so many lessons that you can learn from the book of Daniel. But today we will learn some of the history or some of the prophecies that were revealed to Daniel by an angel, an angelic being that came to Daniel in chapter 11. I will try to cover the whole chapter. It's a long chapter. And if you see me speaking a little faster, it's because I'm looking at the time and I know how much I have to go. But we will look at some of the verses that I believe are the verses that stand out, that are necessary for us to understand some of the things that were being revealed to Daniel. I'm sure it must have been a great thing and a great experience to be able to receive revelation from God as to some of the things that would come to pass. Just think about it for a moment. If you could know what was in the future, some of the questions that you might ask. Many of us would probably ask, when would be the last day of our existence on earth? Or maybe someday we might become millionaires, perhaps. Various questions that people might have in their minds that God in His wisdom decided that He would not let us know. Thereby, we would always be prepared for that day when it would come, the termination of our earthly existence or the destruction of the world. But in this chapter 11, God in His wisdom decides to reveal to Daniel some prophecies, some of the things that would come to pass in the future to the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire. And the reason for it, as best as I could see from my studies, is because of the Jewish people that would be caught in the middle. That is always the worst place to be caught, in the middle. And that is exactly where the Jewish people, the people of God, would be caught. We all, at one time or another, for one reason or other, are discouraged. There's so many things in life that causes discouragement. We all need encouragement. No one can say, I am so encouraged, I don't think I could be encouraged anymore. There are afflictions and sufferings and pressures and problems from all sides of life that we need to have encouragement. It always helps when we know the outcome. As Christians and sons and daughters of God, we know the outcome, that someday we will be in the presence of God Himself. 1 John chapter 3 says we will see the Lord face to face as He is. And therefore we have something to look forward to It's always good to have something to look forward to. And in spite of all the sufferings and the tribulations that sometimes we might go through, the changes in life that we were not expecting, it is very encouraging to know something about the future. And always knowing this, that no matter what, God is in control. God is in control, and that should give us great encouragement. Let us go to chapter 11, first of all, and let's look at verse 2 to begin our study at this point in time. And we read from the book of Daniel, it says, "And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet 3 kings in Persia, and the 4th shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Gracia." It doesn't say who he was. But as we study secular history, we know that it must have been Xerxes. As we see here in the revelation given by this angelic being to Daniel, he overpasses those 3 kings and goes on to the 4th king, who would be Xerxes, because the other 3 kings really did not have too much to contribute to this revelation. But Xerxes would, because he would be a man of great power and of great wealth. Supposedly, according to some of my readings, he gathered up or had an army of 5 million soldiers. Can you imagine 5 million soldiers? I can't even imagine 1 million soldiers. And now, not all were soldiers. You had cooks. You had other kinds of servants that you have in the army. But nevertheless, that must have been a tremendous, tremendous army. And because of that, he stirred up all against the realm of Gracia. Now, that could cause a great stir. Just remember a few years ago in the Persian Gulf, with Saddam Hussein, the thousands and thousands of soldiers that he had. You have a great army in the hands of a man that cannot control power, and you have problems. And therefore here, it talks about Xerxes, and now he goes to verse 3. He goes to another king. "A mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will." Now this would be Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great. This was quite a young man that would become king. "He was the son of Philip, king of Macedonia, whom it is said that he had built up one of the strongest armies in the world." But this Alexander the Great, he would rule with great power. As you have heard before in some of the lectures, Alexander the Great was sort of like a military genius, I guess you could say. In a few years that he was king, he was able, we literally could say, to conquer the world, except he could not conquer himself. And he died because of his drinking problem. It's funny how some men and some women can conquer so much and yet cannot conquer themselves. Alexander the Great could not conquer the vice of drinking, and he died. But nevertheless, he by that time had shown to be a great man in the sense that he ruled with a great dominion, and he did according to his will. And when he died, there was no one to take his place. Those who would have inherited his kingdom were murdered. So the only ones that could take his place were his generals. In verse 4 we read, "And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the 4 winds of heaven and not to his posterity." And that would be his generals. So the kingdom of Alexander the Great was divided into 4 parts, we could say. And later on, we will continue this section of discussion. But before we go into the verse 5, these kingdoms or empires were Macedonia, Thrace, Syria, and Egypt. Now, Macedonia and Thrace will not be discussed in this revelation. The revelation that this angelic being is given to Daniel will deal with Syria and Egypt. Over and over, it will be Syria and Egypt. Syria would be to the north and Egypt would be to the south. There would be wars and confrontations between these two nations over and over, and the Jewish people would be caught in the middle, as I was saying before. That's the wrong place to be caught, but that's where the Jewish people would be. So now verse 5 says, "The king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him, and have dominion, his dominion shall be a great dominion." This is verse 5. This, the king of the south, which would be Egypt, this would be Ptolemy the first. Now there's a lot of history involved here. You know, some people are not very good with faces, and some people are not very good with dates. You know, history is just not that attractive, I guess, to many of us. I have a hard time remembering names, remembering faces, and so on, and dates. So some of this I'll have to look at myself to be able to say the right thing here. But Ptolemy the first would rule from 323 to 306 B.C. And he's described as being strong because he would rule over Egypt. Now, one of his princes, Seleucus Nicator, he would rule from 312 to 280, and he's considered even stronger because he would rule over Syria, and Syria was a larger territory than Egypt. Verse 6 says, "In the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm. Neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times." Look at that verse, and you don't see any names, and you wonder, who are they talking about? And actually, here they're talking about a woman by the name of Berenice. And she would be given to marry the king of Syria, Antiochus Theos. The way it seems to me, according to Old Testament studies that I've done in other places also, and also here, when countries wanted to make agreements, they just did not come together and make agreements. Like nowadays, people want to make agreements, they just make some kind of contract. Back then, it seems to me that if they wanted to have an agreement between countries, they would marry somebody from one country to somebody from the other country. That's the way they would do it. And so in this case, they're going to marry Berenice to Antiochus Theos. And therefore, that would be like a treaty. And you know, when you have the father-in-law on one side, and you have the son-in-law on the other side, even though it is the case that sometimes father-in-laws and son-in-laws don't get along very well, there are a lot of father-in-laws and son-in-laws that get along very well. I think very highly of my father-in-law, and I hope he thinks likewise. But there are many father-in-laws and son-in-laws that have just real fine, good relationships. And so therefore, here, the idea is by marrying off Berenice to Antiochus Theos, they will have a treaty, I guess, with a warranty, maybe we could say, a guaranteed treaty. There was only one problem. There's always a problem, I guess, when you're trying to do things of this sort. There was only one problem, that Antiochus Theos was already married. He was already married to a woman by the name of Leodice. And Leodice had already had some sons from Antiochus Theos. And as if you have studied the history of the Old Testament times, when a king would die, his descendants would take over the kingdom. And therefore, Leodice was not very happy with what her husband had done. Her husband divorced her. First of all, her husband divorced her for another woman. Can you imagine that? Some women, they'll just take up a gun and go shoot the other person, maybe shoot the whole couple. This Leodice had been divorced by her husband so that he would marry Berenice. And so there would be a treaty between Egypt and Syria, and there'd be peace between those nations. Well, that's fine. except Antiochus Theos was already married. And Laodice, more than anything, did not like the idea that her sons, there was a stipulation in the agreement. The stipulation was that the sons by Laodice would not inherit the kingdom. Well, that even made it worse. She lost her husband, and now her sons will not inherit the kingdom. Well, she's not very happy. But you know, we as people, we make all sorts of plans. The book of James, chapter 4, the writer James talks about how sometimes we're even arrogant about the plans that we make. In such a year, I will do this. In such a year, I will do that. And we never know that maybe tonight might be our last night on earth. Our life is like a vapor. It suddenly appears and it suddenly disappears. And we make plans of all kinds. But sometimes our plans do not work. Especially when our plans are not according to the will of God. What Antiochus Theos had done was not according to the will of God under any standard. He went ahead and married Berenice, but 2 years later, Ptolemy Philadelphus, who was the father of Berenice, died. So now this political move is no longer worth anything. What's going to happen? Antiochus Theos, as soon as he hears about his father-in-law dying, he goes back to Laodice. Well, can you imagine? Can you imagine how Laodice feels now? Now he's coming back. Now he needs me. Now he realizes he has no benefit whatsoever with Philadelphus, Ptolemy Philadelphus and Berenice. And therefore he's now back. I can almost imagine what must have been going through her mind. I don't trust him. You know, one of the things that will destroy a marriage in a second is when the trust is lost. When the husband cannot trust his wife anymore, or when the wife cannot trust her husband anymore. So now we go on, and it says that the last portion of verse 6, it talks about neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. What's going to happen now is Laodice is very angry. And she has power. She's not only angry, but she has power. You got a wrong combination there. An angry wife with power. So she sends off messengers after Berenice and her son, so that they will capture them and murder them. For a while, Berenice and her son were able to escape and hide from Laodice. But eventually, they caught up with her and they were murdered. They were poisoned to death. And Laodice believes that she needs to finish out the job. So what she does, she also has her husband, Antiochus Theos, poison to death. How do you like that? This is a very interesting story. And this is all here. Of course, we have to go to various historians to put the information together. Well, here we're not given the names of who are the people that are involved, but reading those historians, you can see that they have ample evidence to support what they say. So you know about vengeance. When people start murdering people, it doesn't stop. It just keeps on going. I don't know what it is about us, but we just normally, or many of us, might want to return evil for evil. Take vengeance on those that have done us wrong. And so therefore, there in verse 7 it says, out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which will come with an army. Now this is a brother of Berenice, who hears about his sister being murdered, and he's going to take vengeance. His name is Ptolemy Ergetes. I want to pronounce it with the Spanish vocabulary, but I'll let it go. Ptolemy Ergetes. Now, this is Berenice's brother, and he would take the place of Ptolemy Philadelphus. Remember, Ptolemy Philadelphus had died before. And so, during that little short time that Berenice and Antiochus were married, there was peace between Egypt and Syria. But now, there is no peace because Ptolemy Ergetes wants to make things right for his sister. So he says there in verse 7 that he shall come with an army and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north. Remember, the north is Syria. And shall deal against them and shall prevail. He would win. Verse 9, in the King James it reads, so the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. You look at the ASV and it says, and he shall come into the realm of the king of the south. What happens here, the he, in according to ASV version, the he is making reference to Seleucus Kallinias, the king of Syria. Now he will bring his army against Ptolemy Ergetes. It just goes like back and forth, fighting back and forth. And the reason that all this is being revealed to Daniel is because the Jewish people would be in the midst of these fightings and wars and confrontations. They would suffer because of this. I guess in a sense you could say it's like in a family when husbands and wives divorce and they have children. The children will suffer the consequences of the actions of their parents. Sometimes people suffer the consequences of the actions of other people. And so therefore the idea here is that this revelation is being given to Daniel, so thereby the Jewish people will receive at least some kind of encouragement. But nevertheless, here in verse 9, Seleucus Kallinias, king of Syria, now he comes against Ptolemy Ergetes, but he would not succeed. But his sons, there in verse 10, his sons shall be stirred up. Now Seleucus Kallinias, king of Syria, had two sons, one by the name of Seronus, and the other one was Antiochus the Great. Well, Seronus would come first. He would reign from 226 B.C., to 223 B.C. And he died. He fell from a horse. And he died. So his reign was short-lived, and so now Antiochus the Great takes over. Antiochus the Great was of a warlike nature. And even though at the time that he takes over, he's only 18 years of age, and you have already seen in this lectureship what some young men can do. Just because they're young, it doesn't mean they can't do a lot. I'm really amazed, and I will always be amazed, how the young know so much. What scares me is when they know they know so much. Or when they're being taught faster than they can learn. But nevertheless, we go on to verse 11. I knew I was going to have problems. But anyway, verse 11. The king of the south shall be moved with a choler and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. So here in verse 11, we have Ptolemy Philopater. He was very angry with Antiochus, and he goes into battle against Antiochus. Ptolemy Philopater only had 75,000 soldiers, but he nevertheless goes against Antiochus, who had an army of 78,000 soldiers, and Ptolemy defeats Antiochus. And Antiochus is what we call a poor loser. He's not very happy about this. Ptolemy, after his victory, instead of following up, as sometimes we fail to follow up on certain matters, he goes back to a life that he was following before, a life of self-indulgence, a life of luxury and dissolution. Meanwhile, Antiochus the Great, he will not remain idle. He will go and invade the east and consequently will acquire an army that will make his army a greater army. And he will want to go back and fight again. Verses 15 through verse 19. Verse 15 says, so the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. From verses 15 to verses 19, I'm going to have to fly, as we say in school. Antiochus the Great will try to fight and defeat. But in his planning, again, he does like Antiochus Philadelphus had done by marrying all Berenice to Antiochus Theas. He goes at it from this direction. He will try to marry off his daughter, Cleopatra, to the king of Egypt, who was Ptolemy Epiphanes at the time, who was only 7 years old. So they're going to have to wait out for that marriage. They wait up some years later, and eventually they do marry. Now, Antiochus the Great is under the impression that his daughter will be loyal to him. But you know how it is with daughters. Once they marry off, they're loyal to their husbands. And the father, well, goodbye, father. So on we go. Verse 20. In verse 20 we read, and then shall stand up in his estate a razor of Texas and the glory of his kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Now, eventually, Antiochus the Great would die. He was actually destroyed in a battle, but he is no longer alive. And now Seleucus the Fourth would take over his place. Seleucus the Fourth had a man under him by the name of Heliodorus. And Seleucus the Fourth will send Heliodorus to Jerusalem, where there seems to be a lot of money, to get money to, so that they be able to pay taxes to the Romans, something that Seleucus' father had agreed to. Heliodorus had plans of his own. Heliodorus, therefore, as soon as he can, will poison Seleucus the Fourth. They keep poisoning one another. I guess that's one of the most common ways they would murder each other. So now we go on from Seleucus the Fourth. He's no longer in existence. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, he will take over. Seleucus the Fourth. And this Antiochus Epiphanes, he named himself Epiphanes, which meant the illustrious one. That's what he called himself. So that kind of gives you an idea what kind of character he had. So now we go to verses 21 to 24. Verses 21 to verses 24. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom. He actually did not deserve the kingdom. It wasn't for him. He kind of took it. And he obtained it by flatteries. And we know flatteries. Normally, how can you tell when a compliment is really a compliment or someone is just giving you flattery? I never have studied the word flattery that much, so I'm not going to say one way or the other whether they be some good flattery and some bad flattery. But nevertheless, how can we know when it is bad flattery? When people flatter you and then they ask you for something. So anyway, here he is a manipulator. He is a person that plots and plans and manipulates, and that's how he gets over the kingdom. And he is described as a vile person, an evil person, a wicked person. And there, verse 23, after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, or he shall come up and shall become strong with the small people, and then he would go upon the fattest places of the province, and also the temples and shrines, and get the silver and the gold and all that. Verse 25, he shall store up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. Verse 26, yeah, they that feed of the portion of his meat. Now he's going against the king of Egypt. The king of Egypt has two that can be kings. Ptolemy Philometor and Ptolemy Pascal. Talamilamater is the one that's reigning at the time, but Talamilamater is betrayed by his own men, and eventually Antiochus will defeat and take Talamilamater as a slave, or as a prisoner, let's say. And after that, Talamilamater's brother, Talamipaskan, takes over. And then after that, Antiochus and Talamilamater, trying to make believe they're working together, they're actually trying to use each other. But whatever the case may be, their plots and plans will not fall in place, because things will not come to pass as they had planned them. For he says in verse 27, both of these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but he shall not prosper. For yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Things happen when God says they happen. Verse 28, then shall return unto his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Verse 30, for the ships of Chittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. He was trying to go against Egypt, but things are not going to work out. In fact, even the Roman people come and say, you will go back. And he has to go back. But he is a very unhappy man. And you know, when people are unhappy, when they're angry, sometimes they don't take it out on the people that made them angry. They take it out on people that just happen to be there. And those were the Jewish people, the people in Jerusalem. I'm going to have to jump ahead. That's why I have my notes here. Let's see. This is what Antiochus the Great will do to the people in Jerusalem. From verses 30 to verses 35, he takes Jerusalem by force. He kills a multitude of Jews. He plunders Jews. He prohibits the sacrifices unto God. He dissolves their laws. He prohibits circumcision. He offers swine upon the altar of God. Antiochus did this by indignation. But in the midst of all these problems that the Jewish people were going through, and all the sufferings and afflictions, God will come and help. There were men by the name of Judas Maccabeus who would fight for the Jewish people, and he would help the people for a period of 6 years. And therefore, Antiochus would no longer do him harm. Verses 36 through 39, we read verse 36, and the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself, magnify himself above every god, speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done. The whole idea is that things will come to pass when God says they are to come to pass. Verse 38, and in his estate shall honor He shall honor the God of forces, and a God whom his fathers knew, and shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. This last verse is actually from verses 36 to the end of the chapter. As I was studying some of the other lectures that dealt with my chapter, I found that there are certain things that are... The only thing I can say is that I'm not absolutely sure. I can only say, I know we deal with that, but based on history, to my best understanding, everything I have studied and read, verses 36 to verses 45 were dealing with Antiochus, the vile person described, Antiochus the madman. So therefore, verses 40 to verses 45. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries, and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land. This would be Palestine. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, and the sheep of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and of the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make a way many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. I believe this is a summary of the endeavors of Antiochus the madman. Antiochus, a vile person, as described in earlier verses. What he did, the wars that he was involved with in Egypt and Syria, the things he had done to the temples and the shrines, to the Jewish people, and so on, and eventually to his end of his existence on earth. He died of madness. That's the best I can say about chapter 11. I had to fly in some places, so I hope I did not confuse you, but if I did, go to the lecture book, make sure you buy one, and you will see it in a slower manner, and will hopefully understand some of the things that were happening here, that were being revealed by an angelic being to Daniel for the encouragement of the Jewish people. Lessons we can learn from chapter 11 is that God is in control. God controls the kingdoms of man. God has his own schedule that he follows. And he will use the activities of people who do not respect or obey his will to providentially make things come to pass as God has willed those things to come to pass.